welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on listen-only until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star 1 to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd now like to hand the meeting over to your host, Dr. Kevin Yeske. You may begin.
All right. Thank you. This is Kevin Yeske. I'm the Principal Deputy in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. And good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining today's technical assistance call regarding the Pediatric Disaster Care Centers of Excellence funding opportunity announcement. Here at ASPR, we're real excited about this opportunity to enhance our healthcare system's ability to provide pediatric care during public health emergencies and disasters. And through our funding opportunity announcement, ASPR will support the creation of up to 2 Pediatric Disaster Care Centers of Excellence that will serve as pilot sites. The pilot sites will build upon the existing foundations for pediatric clinical care and emergency response by enhancing coordination mechanisms and incorporating relevant capabilities at the local, state, and regional levels. The pilot projects are intended to help identify issues, develop best practices, and demonstrate the potential effectiveness and viability of this concept. Recipients of the awards will be expected to develop or improve their capability and capacity to provide highly specialized care to pediatric patients within and outside of their own region through the pursuit of the objectives of this announcement. So again, I want to thank you all for your interest in this opportunity and for being on the call today. I'm now going to hand the call over to my colleague, Tara Holland, to address any questions that you may have.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Dr. Yeske, for providing those opening comments. And again, thank all of you for being on the call today. During the call today, we will have an open question and answer session that will allow you to ask any questions that you might have. But first, I'll just introduce myself. I'm Tara Holland. I'm a program analyst here at the National Disaster Medical System at ASPR, and I've been working closely with the staff on this project, including the project officer, Dr. Helga Scharf-Bell, who will be joining us a little bit later on the call today. Also in the room and on the phone with me, there's some other ASPR staff who can help addressing your questions. We have Jack Herman from the Office of External Affairs, Lauren Walsh from ASPR's Hospital Preparedness Program, Jennifer Ray Gorey from Office of the General Counsel, and also Virginia Simmons will be joining us from the ASPR Grants Office. So before we get started with the open question and answer session, I'd just like to share some overarching thoughts and comments with you. These comments are broadly useful as you conceptualize and begin to draft your applications. First, I just want to mention that we're in the process of developing a question or a question and answer page of frequently asked questions on the ASPR webpage, which can be accessed at phe.gov. That's public health emergency, phe.gov. The questions are not posted as of yet, but we're in the process of posting them, so hopefully within the next 24 to 48 hours, we can have that posted. And that can act as a really great resource for you all as you're preparing your applications. We intend to update this page frequently as we receive more questions, so really focus on that as one of your resources in this and check back on that frequently to get updated information. As the moderator mentioned on this call is being recorded, and hopefully within the next week or so, we will have this call posted to the website as well in both audio and transcript version. So if you know people who weren't able to attend, you can certainly share that resource with them so they can get all the information that we discussed today. Also, I just want to mention the letters of intent. We've received a few from some of you, so thank you for that and for showing your interest in this opportunity. I just want to reiterate that the letter of intent was not required, so if you have not submitted a letter of intent, you're certainly still eligible to apply for this opportunity. Lastly, I just want to stress to you all to please read the funding opportunity in its entirety. I know that it's a very lengthy document, but there is a lot of useful information in there, and as you're putting together your applications, you want to make sure that you're really going through it with a fine-tooth comb and certainly getting out all of the relevant information to put together a strong proposal that meets all of the requirements. So to date, we've received multiple questions from you all. So before we get to the open question and answer, I just wanted to go over some of the most frequently asked questions that we've received to give clarity around some of those things. So first, we received a few questions about the roles and responsibilities of the key personnel under this FOA, including the medical director and the principal investigator or project director. So just briefly, key personnel are defined as all individuals who contribute in a substantive and meaningful way to meeting the requirements of the funding opportunity announcement. The key personnel that's required specifically includes the medical director, and there are specific qualifications that I'd like you to note that are listed within the FOA, so you want to make sure whoever person you designate as that does meet those requirements. And also for the HHS grants management policy, which you can reference for more information, and that'll be listed in the FAQ page on PHE, we are also required to have a principal investigator or program or project director, as well as an authorized organizational representative. And you can, again, reference the grants management policy for more details about what those positions entail and the expectations of those. Also, we received some questions about the use of allowable funds. So generally speaking, grant funds can be used to cover the costs of personnel, consultants, equipment, supplies, grant-related travel, and other grant-related costs. But I'd just like to point out on page 23 for reference in the funding opportunity announcement, it does go over some specific funding restrictions. So I'd just like you to be cognizant of that and reference that as you're moving forward. Also, we've received some questions about the definition of a region, which is listed in the beginning portion of the FOA, but just for visibility, for the purposes of this funding opportunity, we've defined region as a geographic area that's inclusive of at least two states within the applicant's respective region, and in your application, you must define which geographic region you intend to serve throughout the process of the FOA. In addition, we've received a few questions about applicant eligibility, and in the FOA, it does go over who is an eligible applicant, and certainly if you have questions about if your specific entity is eligible, you can feel free to reach out to us, and we're more than happy to have that discussion with you and see if you do meet the criteria specified in the funding opportunity. Lastly, we've received a few questions about the project period and future funding. First, I'll just mention that the project period is 12 months, and recipients are, you need to meet the requirements of the FOA within those 12 months. And in terms of additional funding, we hope that that is something that will be available, but that's going to be dependent upon identified priorities and funding appropriations. And finally, before we turn the call over to all of you, I just want to go over some items about how the application scoring and the process works once we receive all of the applications. And just for reference, this is listed in the funding opportunity in the review and selection process section, and we'll be following the steps that are outlined there. So basically, first, the applications will undergo an administrative review to make sure that they meet all of the required components that are listed in the screening and criteria section. After it goes through and meets all the requirements of this administrative review, we will turn the applications over to an objective review committee who will meet and collect and review all of the applications to make sure that they meet the minimum criteria. And in doing this review, they'll be following the grading rubric, which you can reference on pages 25 to 28 of the FOA. So basically, the applications are scored out of 100 total points, and within the FOA, you can find out those criteria and what points will be allocated for meeting specific requirements of the application. And third, the Objective Review Committee will apply funding priorities to the application, and with these priorities, you can receive up to 5 additional points, and these are referenced on page 28 of the FOA. And then in making final award decisions, AFSR will take into consideration the geographic distribution of applicants. No more than one recipient will be funded per each HHS region. And applications that don't receive special consideration will be given full and equitable consideration during the review process. And finally, the notice of award is authorizing documents from the AFSCME authorizing official, the Office of Grants Management, and the AFSCME Office of Budget and Finance. The notice of award will be sent electronically upon successful review of the application. The notice of the award sets forth the amounts of funds granted, the terms and conditions, the effective date, the budget period. The non-federal share will be provided if applicable in the total project period for which it's supported is contemplated. And again, I know this is a lot of information, but just want to reiterate all of this is available within the FOA to read further details. So lastly, I just want to go over some important dates regarding this opportunity. Applications are due August 27, 2019 at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. Notice of awards will be made at the end of September 2019. The funding must be awarded by AFSCME to the applicant on or before September 29th, 2019, and the project period for this funding opportunity starts on September 30th, 2019. So with that being said, I'll just ask if anyone in the room or on the phone has anything additional to say, and otherwise we can open the lines for question and answers from all of you.
Let's proceed.
Okay, Amber, if you don't mind allowing the participants now to ask any questions that they may have.
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star one. You will be prompted to record your name. Please be sure to unmute your phone. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one, and we will pause for just a moment to allow those questions to start coming through. One moment for your first question. Your first question comes from Chuck Russell. Your line is open.
Thank you, Tara. The application, not the application, the start date notes September 30th. Is that a window at which point it could start after that, or is that a firm start date? The clock starts, 12-month clock starts on that date.
Yes, this is Virginia Simmons, Grants Officer. The project period start date, which is synonymous with the budget start date of 9th, September 30th, is the actual start date of your project activity. So there is no window. That's the official start date, and you can begin your project.
Thank you.
And the project period, to be clear, ends on September 29th, 2020.
Very good. If I have an additional question, shall I ask it or shall I punch in again?
Sure.
So we made note of the overall page limits for each component, but with a significant number of letters of support, is there an overall page limit to the application, or is it unlimited based on the number of letters of support?
So currently within the funding opportunity, and thank you for noting that, the only page limits I believe we apply are to that of the project narrative, which cannot exceed 12 pages, and then I believe we put some funding, or I'm sorry, some page limitations on the CV, but otherwise those are the only requirements with the page numbers.
Very good, thank you. And one last question, if I may.
Sure.
It asks for metrics and data regarding potential impact of interventions. Is that something you might be able to provide examples of in the FAQs at a future time?
Yes, I do believe that we've received that question, and we're working through some answers to that, and they will be posted to our frequently asked questions page.
Great, thank you. That's the end of my questions.
Thank you.
And the next question comes from Roger Smith. Your line is open.
Yes, we had a question from our medical director team. Would we be allowed to use a co-medical director, multiple persons for that role?
I'm
let us confer here for a moment, just to make sure we're clear on the requirement. Jack Kerman from External Affairs. So it is our understanding that for the medical director position, it has to at least reach the 25% amount effort on the project. And so if you have multiple or co-medical directors, as long as it meets that threshold of 25%, again, understanding the spirit of this is that you have adequate subject matter experts to be able to advise the PI and the work plan relevant to the requirements of the FOA.
That's perfect, actually. That answers our question.
And this is Tara. I'll just mention that we estimated that that position would be 25%, but certainly, so however many percentages it takes to meet all of the requirements, that is up to the discretion of the recipient.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Matthew Butler. Your line is open.
Hi. Under Strategy 2, it states to develop a regional deployable pediatric response capability. To be clear, is that a plan and model? Or is that a team that would be able to be operationalized?
So I think, again, we're trying to be as realistic as we can. We have a 12-month period here, and we understand that in order to create a deployable team, there are a number of challenges that you would need to address in order to make that team deployable, not the least of which, if it says in the requirement that that team should be deployable not only within your jurisdiction but also in the region in which you serve, that crossing state lines could be difficult. So the spirit of this is we are trying to better understand the challenges and capabilities of creating these deployable teams, and after this pilot be able to better direct our focus of how we can address those challenges, remove some of those burdens, so we ultimately can achieve what needs to be done, and that is to ensure that our pediatric patients get the right care at the right time by the right people. So developing models, looking and trying to address potential legislative language in order to mobilize those teams and address some of the particular legal nuances around deploying clinical teams within your jurisdiction obviously would be useful in looking at within the scope of this project. Did that sufficiently answer your question, Matthew?
Yes, thank you.
And next we'll go to Karen Greeley. Your line is open.
This is Karen from CA2DMAT. I currently am gone to the AET and AETCC training for adults through NDMS. I was wondering how viable that model is for a neonatal week and a PICU week, and if Miami is currently going to be doing that training or you're going to be looking at the pilot study children's hospitals for this model.
Karen, I think what we want to do is make sure that, again, this is a federal funding opportunity that looks at various models, and we leave this up to the applicants to determine how they're going to meet the requirements of this particular funding opportunity announcement. While the federal government may have particular models and training that we are using now in order to address the needs of pediatric patients, that this is separate and distinct from those models. This is a new pilot to begin to envision, to vision out how we're going to overall meet the needs of our pediatric population in disaster.
Thank you.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. Our next question comes from Michael Frogel. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much. This is Michael Frogel from the National Pediatric Disaster Coalition. I still have a question about the principal investigator as opposed to, you know, the applicant. Are the applicant and the principal investigator the same? There are points assigned, and on page 27, there are various specific things like clinical expertise and CBRN and participation and disaster preparedness issues. So the medical director seems to be clear. Just trying to clarify, the applicant versus principal investigator, is that the same thing? Are those requirements on page 27 basically the principal investigator or not? And secondly, can that be shared, a shared principal investigator? As we kind of said with the medical director, what would be the ability to do that?
So, hi, this is Virginia Simmons, grants officer. The principal investigator can be anyone that the applicant organization designates, and the principal investigators, one of their major responsibilities in regard to the grant is to have oversight of daily operations and administration of that grant. And to answer your, this is your last question in regard to whether or not the principal investigator can be the same as the medical director, absolutely. The recipient or the applicant, that is, has full discretion in terms of the delegations of that role, of those roles. But for the most part, in regard to that principal investigator, yeah, there's a definition on page 27, but I just really needed to highlight their one of their main responsibilities. Did I answer your question? I think you had a second one.
Yeah, the issue was, can there be, let's say there's a separate medical director, can there be co-principal investigators?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so
absolutely.
There can be co-investigators, and if both people have the necessary things that are stated on page 27, let's say there were two people and one has done CBRN, one has done not, okay, but both of them together have accomplished all the goals, will that satisfy the points?
Howard, you're talking about the top of page 27. Does the primary applicant have experience with that sentence?
Right, after the bullets, the next paragraph.
Right, does the primary applicant demonstrate capability for the ongoing complex clinical management of pediatric patients as it applies to those things listed?
And Michael, I think it is helpful to understand that the applicant is really the system, the institution, the facility, much like any grant, it is the institution that is the applicant, and within that institution, they have identified the PI who has the authority vested upon them from the institution to make all decisions around this particular grant, but ultimately is accountable and responsible for meeting the requirements of the grant on behalf of the institution, the applicant.
Right. Okay. So are you saying that the applicant complies with all of those requests? Because it talks about clinical expertise and things like that. I know I'm trying to parse words, but in discussions, we've been trying to address this. So do we have to find one person as in, you know, or two people who have complied with all of those things, or is it just the hospital, the system that's done those roles?
The latter, the system that will fund those roles. And okay, the applicant as a whole is the legal entity responsible for the grant. And those individuals,
right.
The staff, that will satisfy all those requirements within that this criterion that you referenced on page 27
mm-hmm.
would encompass the applicant, the entity.
And so as an example, if you're thinking of a PI who is actually not part of that entity, that would not be that would not meet the criteria. The facility, the institution, has to have ownership, if you will, over that PI, meaning they have to be an employee of that system or some type of legal relationship in order to be able to be an extension of the facility or the institution, which is the applicant to this grant.
Okay, I think that's very helpful. Just a second question. If there are multiple states involved in the FOA and, say, multiple children's hospitals, et cetera, one model is to have kind of like an executive leadership group who would function as almost as the applicant in a consortium, or is it proscribed to one or two hospital systems, et cetera, that would take the primary role, and then the others would be collaborators, supporters, et cetera?
Just give us a second. We're discussing this in the room.
Okay.
So Mike, on page 15, under the eligibility information, you'll see eligible applicants, and there are key words there that says, for the purposes of this FOA, a corporate health system, and then it talks about how it's defined. If you're talking about a consortium of either institutions or individuals that would make up your primary group, that consortium has to be a legal entity as described within this FOA. And if it is not, that consortium is not a legal entity as defined as a corporate health system, then you would have to select a primary applicant, if you will, that meets that criteria.
Okay, that's a very good clarification. And basically, I think it aligns with what you said about the PI, et cetera. It says one or more, which I think led to a little bit of not understanding it appropriately. But it seems like there needs to be a lead organization, and they can bring in others, et cetera, multi-state. So thank you very much for that. That was very helpful.
Great. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Chris Newton. Your line is open.
Thanks. I think the previous questions that Mike and others have raised about the co-PI and the roles of the medical directors and how we structure collaboration was really my primary focus, and I think the team has answered the majority of that. I would like to ask one additional question, though. Are there, for purposes of the grants, restrictions on utilizing federal agencies or entities as subject matter experts, advisors, and collaborators? And what I'm getting at is things like military expertise and having them on as collaborators.
Give us one moment here. So in essence, this is the spirit of this award, and that is fostering collaboration between our federal and private sector partners. On the other hand, the grant cannot supplement a federal resource. So so under the grant, you can't fund a federal employee to carry out your requirements under the FOA.
I understand. Unfunded, advisory role would be acceptable, however, yes? Am I hearing that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Deborah Cools. Your line is open.
Yes, this is Deborah Cools from Las Vegas, and my question is similar to Chris's, but with a little different nuance. some of the trauma centers in our proposed region actually have existing military-civilian partnerships, and we may be able to have subject matter experts from those, and I would assume that a letter of support would be helpful. I'd just like to clarify that. And within our region, we may have more than one military-civilian partnership, and they may be with different branches of the military. Do we need to include all of those partnerships, or can we pick and choose depending upon our needs?
So I think at this first question that you asked, would a letter of support from these military partners be helpful? I don't think that we can address that, whether that would be helpful or not helpful. I think what we are looking at is for the applicant to determine how to meet the requirements of the FOA and the partnerships and collaborations that they need to pull together in order to meet those requirements. Letters of support, as you see in the FOA, are certainly encouraged and supported as inclusion with your application. How far you branch out with those collaborations and partnerships is entirely up to you and part of your application that ultimately will be determined by the review committee. It meets the qualifications and strong enough to carry out the requirements as in the FOA.
Thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one and record your name. We have a question from Vernon. I'm sorry, it's actually Dulce Suarez. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. Dulce here. Quick question. On page 4 of the document, it says future elements of the vision would include field equipment, telemedicine, training, and education. Yet throughout the different activities and throughout the different strategies, we are to weave telemedicine, training, and education. So is that more of a future goal and grasp, or are we correct in reading throughout the document training and telemedicine?
I think what we will need to do, we want to make sure we understand your question sufficiently. So you are interpreting, can you just say that one more time, how you're interpreting the FOA?
Sure. In reading throughout the FOA, it's very clear that telemedicine capability, training, and education should be implemented throughout our activities and strategies. However, on page 4, it states the first sentence, future elements of the vision would include things such as telemedicine, training, and education. So is that a future goal in grasp, or are we to approach that as we've read the entire document, it's very included throughout?
So our interpretation of that is that it is included throughout. So again, the spirit of this, if we know that we are trying to create a system that includes capabilities that make access to equipment, mobile medical facilities, telemedicine, and ensure that the teams who are responding to take care of the pediatric needs are trained and educated adequately to do so, then part of this initial pilot is to look at the feasibility of establishing those capabilities, recognizing that within a year's period of time, there's only so much that you can do. So we're looking for a well-articulated application that recognizes the importance of these capabilities, can speak to whether or not any of those currently exist in your area or how you would go about building those, and where those could be instituted within the 12-month project period, that should be noted, and where those would need to be future capabilities, that should be noted as well.
Thank you very much. Excited to move forward.
Thank you.
We have no other questions at this time, but as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. We did just get another question. One moment, please. The name was not recorded for the Q&A, but we did catch it when you dialed in. So I believe this is Matthew Butler. You may want to check your mute button. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. Sorry about that. Can you clarify the website where this information is going to be posted, where the Q&A is going to be posted?
Yes, it'll be phe.gov. That's public health emergency, phe.gov. I'm not sure exactly where it will be on that site, but it will be there. And certainly if you do like a Google search of PhD ASPR and pediatric FAQ, you should find it. There,
okay.
I will mention there is one that's currently there, which is a little bit outdated. So I've asked our communications team to remove that, and we're in the process of revamping it and putting up the newly revised one specific to just to this funding opportunity announcement. So if you look right now, you might find stuff that's a little bit outdated, but hopefully within the next 24 to 48 hours, we get that sorted out.
Okay, thank you.
We have no other questions at this time.
Great. If there are no other questions, we can end the call.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.